นะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะพุทธังธัมมังสังฆังกุณุตรังอุปัชฌายังนมัสสามิ
I spent a recent Sunday in the company of a friend, Chinese Mahayana monk, abbot of a big monastery, talking about creating bridges between the two traditions and differences between them. And I said, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I don't find the word Hinayana, small vehicle, as insulting, because I think our tradition is like a Ferrari, basically. It's a very small vehicle, but it's for a long journey, I would prefer it to a big truck. We were just teasing each other a little bit. But one point that I wanted to make was that it's not that in the Theravada tradition that we don't give importance or so much importance to helping others. It's merely that, as I understand our tradition, it's like very practical, and we give a lot of thought to all the things, all the obstacles that prevent us from helping others successfully, or the causes and conditions that help us to help others long term. And the principle, I would say, in summary, is that helping ourselves and helping others has to go hand in hand, and that in fact they are inseparable. So I'm sure many of you will have known people in the past who decide to devote themselves to a good cause with great sincerity, and lacking any sense of their own limitations, throw themselves into this work in such a way that after a year or two they're completely burnt out and have to give up. So 1 or 2 years of like fevered activity for others is probably not the wisest and overall most effective way of helping sentient beings. So from this very basic level of looking after our own physical health and knowing our own limitations, this is how we begin and how we approach this. So it's always the kind of practical, kind of boring Theravada approach, you know, rather than the big gesture kind of style. But at the end of 1980, I had the good fortune of being Ajahn Chah's attendant. And at that time, he was staying at a little monastery by the Moon River. He used to go there for a month or so in the winter every year. And this was Lumpho Sumato's first visit back to Thailand after moving here to England. And as I remember it, Lumpho was very positive and very enthusiastic about what was happening here. Everything seemed to be growing suddenly. So many new groups popping up, so many new developments. And after a very trying and difficult period, he was very optimistic about the future of the propagation of the Dhamma in Britain and Europe. And after he'd updated, I guess the word to use, updated Lumpho about all the latest developments, Lumpho, let me see, does anybody know what a dipper is? You know when you've been in Thailand or countries where you have a bath and you tip the water over your head? Oh, so it's a dipper, okay. So Ajahn Chah, Lumpho Chah, said to Lumpho Sumato, Sumato, don't think you're going to empty out the ocean of suffering. If you can just take out a few dippers, you've already done a good job. So, and I always remembered this about you're not having too inflated expectations, but just to apply yourself very consistently to doing the best you can. And it's always only going to be a small drop in the ocean. So, you know, for instance, you could spend your whole life working selflessly to on the AIDS problem in Africa. And then someone could say to you, yeah, okay, but what are you doing for global warming? You know, or what are you doing for this problem or that problem? But we're just one person. You can only do a very small amount in the big picture. But it's that sense of doing what you can do. Now, in the efforts to help others, then the loka dhammas, the worldly winds, tend to become stronger and stronger. And one thing that upsets a lot of people who have a very pure wish to contribute something to their society and their community is the kind of feedback they get. And there is this sense that when you do something good and with a pure intention, then you should get some recognition of it. It's not that you do it for the recognition, but you feel, you know, in the world should be of the nature that it respects and supports good people. And I meet this a lot in Thailand, and so my advice is to reflect that whenever you do a good deed, a public good deed, there are going to be at least five different reactions to it. One is a genuine appreciation, anumotana. Secondly, there's going to be false appreciation, where people will flatter you, and people want to get something for you and praise you with their own ulterior motives. So two kinds of appreciation, true and false appreciation. Then there's going to be another group of people who are completely indifferent, don't see what the fuss is about, and are completely uninspired. And then you have another group of people who will be jealous, and another group of people will be quite angry, because usually when you do something good, then you're usually restricting the opportunities for people to do bad things or reducing their profits in one way or another. So I find this a kind of little algorithm. You know, whenever you do something good, then be ready. Yeah, there's going to be genuine appreciation, false appreciation, indifference, jealousy, and anger. an aversion. And recognizing that and not expecting it to be any other way. So the efforts to help others are often hindered by attachment to views and opinions. So this is a problem that plagues NGOs and charitable bodies. They're all united in their good intentions, but often have very different ideas about how those intentions should be expressed and how money should be used and how power should be exercised and so on. And so if we're not practicing the Dhamma, then this can be really debilitating. And it's for me, it's a really important reminder how we have to keep looking within and seeing opinions as sankharas, as things that we've adopted. They're not who we are. They don't define who we are. We don't have to protect them as if they were ourselves, or our dignity and our standing in the community is dependent upon the survival of this particular view, this particular opinion. And of course, we see this again and again in scientific history of science. Some of the most stubborn opponents of scientific progress have been Nobel Prize winners, or people who've been determined that their theory or their way of looking at things should survive forever. So when we look at opinions, where do they come from? Well, they come from things we've read, things we've heard, some external source. So good reflection is, we can never be 100% sure that external source is correct, or it may have been correct in the past, and no longer in the present. And then our own understanding of that that principle, of that view and idea might be incomplete or might be faulty. So there, when we look at our relationship with views and where views come from, then we begin to see that it's a lot less secure than we might have thought, and that there's a danger in identifying with these views if we see they were just things that we hold lightly. Some of you may be familiar with the Pali word for attachment, or ignorant attachment is upadana. But there's another word which you will also maybe remember is samadana. So when we take the precepts, you say samadhiyami. And that word, it comes from samadana, which is very close to the word upadana. So if you hold on to something with ignorance, then it's upadana. But if you hold on to something with intelligence, with wisdom, with understanding the purpose, the reason for doing so, then it's samadana. And Lumpo Cha used to give an example of a flashlight. You know, if you're walking through a dark area, then you hold on to your flashlight. You don't let go of it. And then when you come out of the cave or the dark tunnel or the dark area, then you can put your flashlight away again. So, but while you need it, you're holding on to it. You're holding on to it with a clear understanding of why you're doing that, and a clear purpose and a measurable effect. So it's not that we can't hold on to anything at all, but we hold on to things in the way of samadana rather than upadana. So we have views, and we can express our views and defend our views, But we have to have that kind of mindfulness and clarity and excuse me, truthfulness, satya, barami, which is recognizing our relationship to that view. So it's something that we've invited into our mind for a certain period of time. It's not part of who we are. And we also should be constantly monitoring our reactions when we express an opinion and somebody reacts to it. So although in daily life, maybe there's not so much time for formal practice, if you have a foundation of awareness and wakefulness, then you have a readiness to be learning from your experiences. And I think this is probably the, you know, a good way of understanding or characterizing this practice in daily life is a learning. Everything's learning process. You know, what can I learn here? So you're going into a meeting, for instance. Now, how we excuse me, how we approach, how I suggest you approach the practice in daily life is based upon the four right efforts in the Eightfold Path. So the first is the effort to prevent the arising of as yet unarisen unwholesome dhammas. Secondly, in the event that you're unable to do that and an unwholesome dhamma has arisen, then you're making the effort to deal with that wisely and efficiently. You're making the effort to bring into your mind, to bring up wholesome dhammas that have as yet not arisen, and to take care of those that have arisen. So wherever you are, whether it's at home, whether it's in the workplace, whether whatever you're doing, you may not have much time to sit and look at your breath to do the formal meditation practices. But if you look at practice in terms of these four right efforts, you will find that in one way or another, you can always be practicing one of these four efforts and be always on the Eightfold Path. So, for instance, going into a meeting, friends, then you might just consider beforehand, what are the kind of unwholesome dhammas that tend to arise or have arisen in the past in meetings? They think, well, I tend to get irritated when people talk too long, or they don't keep to the point. So my spiritual practice in this meeting is to protect my mind, not allow it to become irritated when that happens. Or or you might notice that you feel kind of dismissive of the ideas of people you don't like, and maybe overly receptive to the ideas of people you do like. So allowing your personal likes and dislikes to affect your decision making. So that's another thing to be aware of and to prevent from occurring. And then maybe when people are talking, you find your mind going off into daydreams and imagination, falling prey to boredom. How can you prevent boredom from arising in the mind? How can you develop listening skills and really give that sense of respect and interest to everyone who speaks? So there's so many things that you can practice, Dhamma practices, in a meeting. And then, as I mentioned before, when it's your turn to speak, what goes through your mind? Do you want to be liked? Do you want to be respected? Do you want to be accepted? How do you feel when somebody dismisses your ideas and your words, or don't seem to give them very much respect? How does that feel? How can you deal with that? So when we have this idea of learning and effort, putting forth effort into practice, there was on one occasion the Buddha was asked to categorize his teachings. This is the the Indians' culture of that time, they were very big on categories and questions and set questions, and in many cases the Buddha just would refuse to play the game. But on one occasion he was asked to characterize what kind of teaching is this, and he says this is a teaching of effort. And what he meant by that is, well, he was defining it in relation to the teachings, the religions of the time that taught that everything was a plan of a god, everything was predestined, and therefore why put effort into practice of abandoning and cultivating if everything's already been decided. And similarly, those people who believed in sort of random materialist ideas, if nothing has any meaning or any real consequence, then why abandon, why cultivate? So the Buddha was saying this is his teaching is one of effort, because recognition of the law of karma and that real change can be effective through human effort. And he made effort this central feature of his sasana, or his education system, as I would call it. And going back to Wat Bopong and Ajahn Chah, in the old days, I remember that at the end of an evening meeting, his way of telling us to go off and meditate rather than going straight to bed was, go and put forth effort, by Tam Kwan Pien. So this real emphasis on effort, and it's through effort, right effort, intelligent, balanced effort, that we can find a sense of balance and joy in practice. You know, if our practice is too goal-oriented, and we become overly obsessed with the ups and downs of daily practice, then it's a really can be a real drudge, and it can be really hard work. But when we're finding joy in the effort itself, then everything becomes very light. And in one of the suttas, where the Buddha is talking about the noble lineage, he says one of the characteristics of the noble ones, or of monks and nuns in the noble lineage, is that they find joy in abandoning defilements and developing kusala dhammas. So it's not necessarily the results, it's in that sincere, intelligent, consistent effort that we can find real refuge in our lives. If we're always looking up ahead, it's a long way to go, and we can be discouraged, lazy. But when we see that this is it, this is already the fruit. The fruit lies in the consistent application and following the path. So in following the path, we're already realizing the fruit. The path is the fruit in one way. So this in our daily life, trying to help ourselves and help others. So the less tension, the less stress, the less anxiety, the less anger that we have in ourselves, the more joy we feel, the more relaxation, the more calm, the more stability, then the more we have to share with others. When we feel full of anger and stress and so on, you say we feel depleted. We don't feel we have anything to share with anybody else. And you feel very poor. You know, when you're miserable and depressed, you feel poor. You don't feel you don't have anything to give anybody. But the more you feel that sense of inner stability and clarity and joy, then you're just overflowing. You just have so much to give. And it flows naturally, and you can see this if you're fortunate enough to have met a monk like Ajahn Chah or Lumpo Sumato. You can see that they have so much to give because they've taken care of their own heart consistently over so many years. So the way that we allow ourselves, the way that we enable ourselves to really contribute to our families and our community and our society begins at home and begins with this home, our body and mind, knowing how to take care of it. And again, I'd really like to stress these four right efforts. So what are you doing when you're meditating? You meditate on your breath. Your first effort is to prevent hindrances from arising in the mind, unarisen, unwholesome dhammas. In the case where your mind does wander and hindrances arise, then you seek to abandon the unwholesome dhammas. You're seeking to cultivate the wholesome dhammas, particularly the bojangas, the enlightenment factors, those enlightenment factors not present in the mind, trying to bring into the mind, and then to take care of and to further cultivate and to bring the enlightenment factors that are present to maturity. Four right efforts. In your daily life, you get up in the morning. I'm really in favor of chunking, which is not a city in China, but it's a practice whereby you just divide the day up into short sections. So from when you get up in the morning until when you leave for work, maybe if you've got a long commute or drive, then the drive itself, morning session, lunch session, afternoon session, evening session, night session, and then reestablish intention for your practice at each new beginning in the day. And so having chopping a long stretch of time into shorter stretches, more manageable stretches of time, and reestablishing your commitment to these four right efforts, I think is a very practical way of approaching this Dhamma practice. So my time is up, and I'd like to end the Dhamma talk at this point.